What if your top salesperson was 1,000 times more efficient? And what if a limitless digital workforce helped your number one find leads? A super team working 24/7 on their behalf, thinking, acting, and solving complex tasks so more deals closed. What if with every sale, each customer felt like they were the only customer? That would be one very efficient sales leader. Now, imagine if every person on your team worked to the power of 1,000. They can with Agentforce, the powerful AI from Salesforce.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. To the Pacific. The Indo-Pacific is the new battle zone anticipation for the 21st century. In the Indo-Pacific is the U.S. Navy and our allies, the President of the United States, traveling through Asia these last days, is touching upon many of the threatening issues, trade and war, that will dominate the conversation over the next 100 years. This is a vast canvas, and I'm very happy to welcome Patrick Tucker, the technology editor of Defense One, because he's going to take us into a thinking, fresh thinking, about the defense of the Pacific, the Indo-Pacific, from a predator state, perhaps Russia and China, perhaps China. We head to Guam. This is in the Micronesia section of the Pacific. This is a vast ocean. Patrick, a very good evening to you. Thank you for this. For quite some time, I've been taught to say they're carrier killers and they're Guam killers. Guam is the centerpiece of interest, because if the People's Republic of China is to make an aggressive step, say against Taiwan or against Korea or against Japan, but chiefly Taiwan, Guam is a matter that they must deal with right away. What's on Guam that is of such strategic interest to our adversaries and to the U.S. Navy? Good evening to you, Patrick.
Good evening. So Guam is the leading edge of where the U.S. would probably stage some sort of military action in the Pacific if it had to do so to deter China from a military invasion of Taiwan or something along those lines. You have forces in South Korea. They're very it's a large group of forces. They're there primarily to deal with North Korea. If you start talking about the island chains, what Guam represents is there's a naval base there too, a marine base, an air base. That is the base from which, if you were going to do a bomber combat air patrol, if you were going to fly bombers over the Pacific as a part of heavy potential military action, Guam would be the place that they depart from. And it's also where, if you were the Marines or even the U.S. Army, which is also looking at this, so you were to deploy expeditionary on-the-ground infantry combat teams to different islands or things like that, Guam would be the point at which you would start to figure out where to put them and how to do it. So it's incredibly important for U.S. strategic posture in the Pacific, particularly as it looks to deter China from what people think is their timeline for a possible military action against Taiwan, which INDOPACOM former chief Admiral Phil Davidson has said, and very recently, STRATCOM Chief Admiral Richards has said, sometime in the next 5 to 6 years. So this is an incredible timeline in which the United States has very little window to try and convince China that this would be a massive military disaster if they were to try and stage this military takeover of Taiwan. So what you saw recently was Vice Admiral John Hill, who's the head of the Missile Defense Agency, talking about the missile defense challenge of Guam, how to protect Guam from, exactly as you put it, those carrier killer missiles, those long-range fires that China has developed, which create what some people call an anti-access aerial denial zone. Basically, China uses these missiles as a threat to kind of keep everybody that they need to outside of what area that they control. And they would probably target Guam in the event of some sort of major uptick in tensions or military conflict with China.
Let's lay out the map. Guam is north of Australia and east of the Philippines. It's on approximately the same latitude as Southeast Asia. It is in the Northern Mariana Islands. Also of interest to China is an embassy that's departing momentarily to visit several of the islands surrounding Guam. I'm looking at the Republic of Kiribati as a possible visit because there's a conversation about the PRC developing joint civil-military facilities at Kiribati, the same at Vanuatu in Melanesia. There's talk of Tonga. There's certainly talk of the Solomons because there is an agreement that's been signed between the PRC and the Solomons most recently, very controversial. And then to the west of that, we have Papua New Guinea. All of this territory is moving, a moving story. So we're concentrating on Guam because this is Fortress Navy, Fortress U.S. right now, from what we see of the PRC seeking ways to get outside of the first island chain where the Navy had confidence it could bottle up the aggression. What is important here is Patrick reporting on news that the U.S. military wants an integrated command center at Guam for Indo-PACOM, Indian Ocean and Pacific Command. What would that look like, Patrick? What power would that give the Navy that it doesn't have now?
Well, so this command center would be very specifically for missile defense. There's Indo-PACOM has a really wide footprint. The command center that the Missile Defense Agency is talking with Indo-PACOM about putting there would help Indo-PACOM figure out that challenge of all of the different missile defense technologies that it has on and around Guam, how to use them to best effect to basically protect the island from the variety of different missile threats that would be coming at it. And, it's an incredibly difficult job because you have incredibly complex and sophisticated missiles now in the Chinese arsenal that could be used. On Guam, they have a thing called THAAD, which is Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System. It basically sits on land and it can shoot down missiles of like a certain altitude. You have destroyers, naval destroyers that are outfitted with standard missiles, Standard Missile 3A, Standard Missile 6. These, over the last couple of years, have been innovated to intercept incoming missiles at a higher altitude. But the challenge is that the new class of hypersonic, highly maneuverable hypersonic missiles that China has developed that they are have in their inventory, they're ahead of the United States in the development of these types of missiles, make it really difficult, if not impossible, to intercept those with the traditional ballistic interceptor, something that just fires straight up and it hits the incoming missile at the predicted azimuth. You know, if you have anybody in the audience remembers Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon basically described the way missiles work for a very long time until recently with the development of highly maneuverable hypersonics that go up into space, or near space rather, and then they, in that near space domain, maneuver chaotically to avoid interception, traveling at five times the speed of sound, that's what hypersonic designates, and then hitting their target. So it's unclear yet how to defend against those. But what is needed right now, according to the Missile Defense Agency and Indo-PACOM, is a command center for defense, for missile defense specifically. There's other command centers that might be looking at different things. But for missile defense specifically on Guam, to counter whatever threats they can in the missile domain.
A technical term. What is a seeker? How does it work with an interceptor missile?
So the seeker is the guidance that goes on the interceptor missile and kind of the nose. And that is sort of like the brains of the interceptor. That is what is, as the missile is traveling through the air, looking for the incoming missile is supposed to be hitting, the seeker is the sensors, a variety of different sensors that help it to figure out how to adjust its path so that it can strike that incoming missile. It's incredibly sophisticated. And the thing with trying to stop a highly maneuverable hypersonic is that the atmospheric conditions of any missile that's operating in that domain, it's just nothing that people are like used to figuring out. Because you're not quite in space, you're still, depending on what part of the flight path, you're going to experience a lot of friction. You're going to experience incredibly high temperatures, and then also perhaps incredibly low temperatures, and obviously rapid acceleration to very high speeds. And so there's the question for trying to stop these highly maneuverable hypersonics with these interceptors is, how do you make it so that this little sensor pod that's going to sit in the nose of that missile can collect all the data that it needs to find the thing that it's supposed to hit, but you're still protecting it from that huge variety of atmospheric conditions that the missile is going to experience as it goes up near space and then rips through a very thin atmosphere coming back down to strike its target and experiencing incredibly high temperatures. So that is a major physics challenge that is stands in the way of effectively defending against the most important missile threat of the 21st century.
In addition to the hypersonic missile threat, Admiral Charles Richard, I'm following Patrick's reporting earlier this month, the commander of the U.S. Strategic Command, told the Congress that the intent of China is to reunify with Taiwan by 2027, as Patrick has outlined. But in this instance, he mentioned low-yield nukes. Is this imitation of the way Putin has talked, Patrick, or something new?
So this suggests what a lot of people have been saying, which is that China is watching what is going on in Ukraine very, very carefully. There's, of course, a lot of lessons to be drawn from what's going on in Ukraine. You can really take your pick. You should have an NCO corps as one. You shouldn't contract out a lot of your maintenance to corrupt members of your military as another. But a third one is that threatening to use nuclear weapons to deter, for instance, NATO forces from entering an area you're trying to control actually does work. NATO forces, the U.S., et cetera, have been incredibly reluctant and cautious about putting any boots on the ground, as it were, in Ukraine, been very limited in some of the help that they've been providing, obviously a lot of arms, but beyond that, it's not the sort of aid that the United States has helped other militaries with in the past. And the simple fact that Russia is a nuclear power plays to that. So this is an example of what Richards calls nuclear coercion, which is kind of bullying states to not interfere with a objective, in this case that Russia has, but in the future that China could have, and using the threat of nuclear war or rather some sort of nuclear event as kind of a bully stick. Now, the U.S., when we think about nuclear war historically in the Cold War, you think of mutually assured destruction. You kind of think of the sort of Terminator franchise. You think everyone fires all their missiles, and then you're left with like a bleak, unpopulated hellscape type of thing. The future of nuclear coercion actually probably looks very different from that, because while the U.S. and the Soviet Union were making strategic nuclear weapons, great big ones, putting more warheads, as many as they could, on missiles, Russia, or the Soviet Union, and now definitely Russia, also worked on variable yield nuclear weapons. They're actually much smaller. They're sometimes, depending on the yield, called tactical nuclear weapons. So these things actually can be, Russia's developed some that can be fired from a tank gun or from an artillery system that, like the size of a howitzer. So that creates the possibility of a much more limited nuclear event as part of a conventional conflict. And China also has pursued that strategy. So they have really a wide variety of different nuclear weapons and warheads, they don't have the same number at all that the United States or the former Soviet Union and that Russia have, but they don't need them because the threat of even a singular nuclear event is probably persuasive enough that they don't have to radically like add to the number in their arsenal. They don't have to threaten to destroy the world for them to be convincingly threatening with the potential use of one nuclear weapon. And so what Richardson is talking about is the possibility of in the event of a major boil up in tension or possibly even a conflict over the military defense of Taiwan, the possibility of China using that nuclear threat card as a means to affect U.S. and allied policy and behavior in defense of Taiwan.
The admiral also asks for Congress to consider, quote, pursuing a low-yield non-ballistic capability. Does that mean we want tactical nukes back on the fleet? We have about a minute.
Richards certainly does. Richards has been very much on the record of wanting to pursue some sort of low yield or variable yield nuclear weapon. We had that in the budget during the last administration. Joe Biden removed the development of that from the budget this year. And there's really kind of no consensus on whether or not the U.S. could use that sort of thing to any great effect. But Richards definitely thinks that it should be part of the arsenal.
Patrick Tucker is the technology editor of Defense One, and we're discussing the defense of the Indian Pacific Oceans and all of the republics, all of the island, but especially Guam and Hawaii in the 21st century. There's one more advantage that I'm told China enjoys, which is development of AI when we come back. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.
Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never-tested-on-animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.